The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.
Welcome to Crime and Justice Radio, where we talk all things crime, justice, mayhem, and the courts with expert insiders and legal outcasts. I'm your host, Aida Leisenring, and I'm here with co-host Bruce Barquette. How you doing?
Good evening, Aida. How are you?
I'm well.
Excellent. Excellent.
I'm always well. I always say well. But I got to tell you, you were right. I'm going to give you credit where credit is due.
Mike, roll the tape here.
So for years now, you've been saying, I can't wait for Trump to be off the news so that the news can focus again on crime. And boy, is it focused on crime. In just 1 week, we've had the criminal conviction of Robert Durst. Gabby Petito disappeared. Her remains were found. Julius Jones, who is an innocence case on death row, had the parole board recommend his commutation, and yet the criminal appeals court officially set his execution date for November 18th. We've had the 11th inmate at Rikers die this week. Our governor just authorized the release of 191 based on the utter mayhem that is the Rikers situation. MCC, which housed El Chapo, Jeffrey Epstein.
Jeffrey only for a short time.
For a short amount of time. Paul Manafort for a brief period.
Alleged terrorists.
Bernie Madoff is finally, and many of our clients, is finally being closed for construction. And we have these two amazing guests that are going to talk about prison conditions, both at MCC, the Federal Detention Center in Manhattan, and Rikers Island. Tina Longo of the Legal Aid Society, and we have Tyrone Covington.
He's the president of the Corrections Officers Union that work at MCC in Manhattan.
So for once in our life, I'm like, for once in my life, I'm going to start singing. Defense attorneys and correction officers are aligned for the same cause, because when the conditions are this drastic, dire, and when such a humanitarian crisis is occurring in prisons, you have to remember the people that work there have to sustain them as well.
That's very true. When we've been complaining about the conditions at MCC for a couple of years now on behalf of one of our clients, and we've made note of things like rodents, insect infestation, heating and cooling problems, ventilation problems, safety and the like. And what it never occurred to me is that the corrections officers, who I thought would not like us for complaining about these things so publicly and so loudly and in court so often, actually have an equal stake in this. And I don't want to speak for them, but when they go to work, if there are rodents, they have to deal with them. If there's insect infestation, why did I lose the word?
Do you want me to take it from here, Bruce?
If there's insects
infestation,
that they have to deal with that. If there's problems with the heating and ventilation and the cooling and whatnot, they have to deal with that as well.
Imagine walking into your office today, wherever your office is, and you're faced with mice, rats, feces, garbage, rotten food, one toilet for 100 people. Would you continue to work there?
And they don't have a choice. They have to go in. And you have to remember, when a corrections officer goes to work, it's not like you or I going to work. They're in until somebody comes in to replace them. They do 8, sometimes 16-hour shifts, because if somebody doesn't show up, you have to stay. You can't leave posts unmanned or unattended to.
Unwomaned. Unpersoned. Gabby.
I want to go back to the jail conditions is going to be the theme of the show. We're going to have Mr. Covington on in just a minute or two. And we'll talk about talk to Tina Longo from her perspective at the bottom of the hour. But I want to go back to Julius Jones for a second. Because Julius Jones, what a week for this man, right? Last Monday, he had his hearing before the parole board.
And it was a first of its kind, Bruce. They've never done a commutation hearing of that type with a death row inmate.
And they did this. And of course, Julius Jones' case was nationalized by The Last Defense, an ABC documentary, which you, along with Viola Davis and Vanessa Patkin, co-executive produced. So in large part, you. Live on air, you could watch it via Zoom, which we did, saw him win, saw 3 out of 4 members vote to commute his sentence, in part because of the significant doubt of his guilt, not because they thought he needed mercy or it wasn't that bad of a crime.
It was predominantly on his innocence
claim. They literally said, because we have grave doubts about the integrity of the conviction. And that's fantastic. But the way it works in Oklahoma is you have to win that vote, and then they recommend to the governor what happens. And so in that, we're waiting for the governor to decide. And in the meantime,
the Criminal Court of Appeals in Oklahoma sets it for November 18th. If nothing happens on November 18th, he is set to die. And you may not be certain about his innocence, and I deeply believe in it. And so do, you know, probably over 6 million people that are aware of his case. But there's certainly doubts. And I actually want to circle back before we go. But
that's a significant thing. This, the parole board said this. This was not his lawyers. This is not you or me talking. This is not, you know, it's celebrities and Kim Kardashian and Dak Prescott, both of whom support Julius. This is the parole board who routinely rubber stamps whatever goes on in the system.
Right, and denies.
Exactly.
And ordinarily it's based on mercy, not on actual innocence and doubt.
So we're really going to execute somebody, whom the parole board voted to commute their sentence because of grave doubts about the integrity of the conviction.
And I want to segue to an entirely different topic, but we have to discuss it a little tiny bit. Gabby Petito disappeared. Her remains were found, and the prime suspect is on the lam. Bruce,
on the lam.
Where do you think he is?
I don't know where he is, and we all can speculate. There's a substantial possibility, I suppose, that he not only was a participant in her demise, but then ended up taking his own life. We'll have to wait and see. This story, I mean, gripped the nation for a week or two, and unfortunately, it wasn't much of a mystery because it turned out to be pretty much what we all thought, that she'd be found and he'd be accused. Now he's disappeared, and really there's a great deal of, I think, blame on the police department in Florida. How do they let this guy just wander off? Not that they should have arrested him, but they should have been keeping track of his whereabouts, tailing him, following him, surveilling him. Nothing happened. So
I'm sorry to the Petito family. They're a Long Island family, and they're suffering the most immeasurable sense of loss right now.
And to a Laundrie family as well. They didn't participate in whatever took place, for sure. And they lost are losing a son and a potential daughter-in-law. It's devastating for everybody involved. Unfortunately, it looks like this was not an accident, but a deliberate act. We'll have to wait and see. Let's get to our theme of the show, which is jail conditions. I know we have Mr. Covington on the line, who is the president of the Corrections Officers Union that oversees MCC. MCC is the Metropolitan Correctional Center that most infamously kept Jeffrey Epstein for about 2 months.
El Chapo, Paul Manafort, Bernie Madoff, and other high-profile inmates, and then low-profile inmates, many of which, are not charged with violent crimes. So, Mr. Covington, are you on the line?
I am. How are we today?
Very well. Thank you so much for coming on our show. We really appreciate it. As the union president, how many members do you currently preside over?
We have about 220 members.
And these are members that work at MCC, right?
Correct. That's correct.
Now, what is the predominant, what are some of the complaints that they have about their working conditions? And we say work, but you kind of live there half the day.
So, yes, our staff come in, that comes to work every day. You know, they work 8 hours sometimes, in some cases 16 hours. And being professional law enforcement as they are, they're tasked with keeping the orderly running of that institution. And so, like some of the issues that we've talked about in other articles, that our staff have concerns about rovenness, you know, this rovenness, staffing levels, more importantly, staffing levels. We have proper staffing levels, you have a safer jail. So our staff are absolutely concerned about those things. I don't think that we find that we are less concerned about some of the same things that the inmate population is concerned about. No one wants to come in and have a mouse or roaches, you know, just around them. So we are absolutely concerned about those types of things also.
What about the temperature? Because Bruce and I routinely go into MCC, and it seems like a small thing, but if you're spending hours with your client and you're freezing cold and you don't have access to extra coats or clothing because you don't know if it's going to be cold or blistering hot, it's tough to deal with just as a visitor who's there for only 2 hours. But what's that like for the COs?
Well, look, we work in those conditions, and those conditions are concerning to us because we don't have a way to regulate the cold. We don't have a way to regulate the heating. And so we learned really quick that either it's going to be very hot or it's going to be very cold. Unfortunately, MCC New York, like most federal prisons, is over 30 years old. And so MCC New York specifically, our heating and air condition, for the most part, is not controlled by the facility. It's controlled by the United States Attorney's Office.
Wait a second. Now, we've talked about this before, but I want to kind of put an exclamation point next to it. This facility is a 10 or 11-story building in the heart of downtown Manhattan, right? It's a fairly prominent building. It did house hundreds of inmates with hundreds of guards in there as well. And you're telling our audience that the heating and cooling is not controlled internally, but by the U.S. Attorney's Office, which is in another building adjacent to it?
So, correct. We have our correction law enforcement professionals are relying on the AUSA's office to give us heat, to give us air condition as the seasons turn. And so our staff, our facility staff, they're doing an amazing job of doing all they can do to keep the building appropriately at appropriate temperature. But it's very little they can do if they don't control the thermostat, right?
Nothing you can do if you can't control the thermostat. Now, the building itself was built in the 1970s, so it's closer to 50 years old, right?
It was designed, I've heard different reports, but I understood it was designed for 350, maybe up to 500, but it's been housing anywhere from 750 to 800 inmates. Is that fair?
That is correct. But that, again, I will say this. That is not the making of the Bureau of Prisons. That is the making of people being incarcerated at pretrial facilities and not having enough pretrial facilities. So when we look at that, those people, we haven't asked for inmates, for people to come in and be held at MCC New York. People are being arrested. Guilty or not guilty, but they're being arrested and they're coming to MCC New York. And so they have to have a place to house them. If we're going to fix that system, then we have to be able to look at spending more money into prisons to have appropriate numbers.
Or frankly, having the U.S. government consent to the release of individuals that aren't accused of violent crimes, aren't flight risks, and are presumed innocent, right? Because you could essentially release 30% of those individuals without any real harm to the public.
Well, I'll say this. I think that prison reform is something that's been on the block for a long time, has been talked about. We've seen some great prison reform come about with the First Step Act, and I think that's something things like that need to continue to happen. But, you know, I don't believe this opened the floodgates, but I think we need to look at things. We need to reevaluate what we do with prisons. And that doesn't start with the Bureau of Prisons, right? That starts with congressional leaders. That starts with the White House. And so if we're going to go down that road, then that's where we start. The Bureau of Prisons doesn't say, hey, bring people in. It is tasked with making sure that people who are brought in stay in. And so it has to be something that Congress looks at. It has to be something that the White House looks at to determine what we do next. And how do we can make things different.
How understaffed have you guys been? I mean, given the increase in the prison population over the decades at MCC, what it was designed for, do you feel like it's sufficiently staffed, or are there too few people putting in too many hours?
Well, look, we've been calling for a long time that the Federal Bureau of Prisons staff these prisons properly. But I don't want to leave it there. I don't want to leave it with the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Ultimately, we have Congress folks who come into our prison systems and they walk around, they do tours, they have media statements, but they're not funding the Federal Bureau of Prisons the way they need to. They're not paying the staff the money that they need to be paying them. They're not taking care of these facilities. So when you look at the fact that the Bureau's budget for this, say, facilities itself, for its building and facilities maintenance, is $250 million in that range each budget year. With 120 facilities, there's no way you maintain facilities with that type of money. When you're looking at a place like MCC New York, who is estimated that $100 million is needed to just simply repair that building. The blame of what's happening in federal prison, to me, has to start with Congress. It has to start with Congress, has to start with the White House, and we have to look at it and say, hey, what can we do? Sure, the Federal Bureau of Prisons plays a role. Sure, the Department of Justice plays a role. But if you don't have the money to maintain these facilities, you can't just simply spend money, right? The rest of the Federal Bureau of Prisons could be in prison for spending money, misappropriating money that he hasn't been given.
Well, that's a great point. And you know what? Maybe we'll have a congressman on or a congresswoman on to talk about the funding for the Bureau of Prisons to make sure that things are staffed and held properly. You had two union members, I think, arrested and charged a couple years ago for the death, or not for the death, but as a result of the death of Jeffrey Epstein, who killed himself. And they were charged with not doing certain tasks that they were supposed to be doing. And I read a quote, and I don't know if it's from you or from somebody else, to say, if you're going to charge somebody in the facility for this death, you have to charge everybody. You have to charge the system, because there's literally not enough people to do all the work that we're mandated to do. It was that accurate?
That is accurate. There is no way that you can ask people to do a job without giving them the resources and enough staff to do it. The bottom line is the system is broken. And if the system is not fixed, then the system will continue to be broken. And it's not broken in New York. It's broken around the country. In the Bureau of Prisons, I disagree with them sometimes, but the Bureau of Prisons and our staff are doing the best they can with what they have. And so when I hear judges and media outlets being this so harmful, saying harmful and hurtful things about our staff, I say to you, come on into the prison, put a uniform on.
Walk a beat. Or be quiet.
To exactly. Undercover boss.
But that's critically important. Critically important
and,
point.
And also, I mean,
to see what we're dealing with. And then if you're able to do that, then you understand the reality that every man and woman who works at MCC or every federal prison around this country is dealing with. It's not happy time for.
For what it's worth, every time I've come in there, your members have treated me with utmost respect, and I treat them with respect because I realize how difficult their job is. And even in a New York Times article in 2017, they said the prison was called, or the jail was called, less hospitable than Guantanamo Bay by one inmate that had been incarcerated at both. And that's not because your members are not being hospitable. It's because it's grossly under-resourced. And when you put inmates in that condition, it leads to depression, it leads to mental health issues, it leads to danger, threats, and violence, and that puts your members at risk. It isn't right, and you deserve better.
Good for you. Good for the work that you're doing. Thanks so much for coming on the show with us. Stay safe. Keep doing your good work. It's important work. And we'll have a congressperson on to talk about the funding, because I think that's critical. Thanks.
Absolutely. I think funding is the most important thing that can happen for the Bureau of Prisons.
Thanks very much. We'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Bye, Mr. Covington. Welcome back to Crime and Justice Radio. I'm Aida Leisenring. I'm here with Bruce Barquette. Our next guest has the inside scoop to the war zone that is Rikers Island, and that's all over the news right now. Tina Longo is the attorney in charge of the criminal defense practice at the Legal Aid Society here in New York, the largest and oldest defense practice. Tina is a true warrior and a fighter for those without a voice and the thousands and thousands of incarcerated individuals. Tina.
One second. Before we get to Tina, hang on 1 second. I want to remind people that we just had on the president of a corrections union who oversees MCC. This has got to be one of the rarest of rare shows where you literally have a corrections officer, the president of the union, and a legal aid attorney coming on a radio show to talk about the same problem, which is the conditions in these facilities. And it points back to a lack of will. Simply our society, our politicians, our office holders, our political leaders are allowing this to happen. And we have an excellent perspective from the corrections officers who say they're understaffed and underfunded. And now we want to get to legal aid attorney who has a number of clients in there that can tell us what the conditions are like for the inmates. Welcome, Tina. Sorry to cut you off there.
No. Thanks very much. I think it's a really critical conversation to have from both perspectives. So I really appreciate you trying to educate as many people as to what is going on. Because when you reflect on a society, you have to look at the ways in which a society, right, treats the most vulnerable. And here, that's the crisis of Rikers at this moment.
And let's get to it, because big news hit maybe last night. For me, it was this morning. The 11th inmate this year has died on Rikers Island. Can you tell us about that? Were they your client?
Yeah, this was Mr. Kareem was our client. He was a father of two young children, and you know when someone who isn't either who doesn't work as any of the stakeholders sort of thinks about the people at Rikers Island, your mind goes to the worst of the worst, right? You sort of read the sometimes in the newspapers the headlines about the fear mongering, but let me tell you about the reality of many people at Rikers. Mr. Kareem was in on a technical parole violation. He had no underlying new case. He wasn't arrested for any allegation. He was put back in Rikers without any ability to make bail, so what we call remand, for use of marijuana as reported in 2018 and failing to show up for parole visits, which the Department of Corrections, State Corrections, calls absconding.
And
so no new, right?
Right. And from what I understand, he also had special medical needs and was in a wheelchair, right? And you said he was a father of two.
That's right. Father of two, huge medical needs, wheelchair, and parole decides to, instead of finding out what the underlying causes were for him to not come to his appointment, recognizing that as a society, certainly here in New York State, we've all come to the reckoning that marijuana use should not be illegal. So what parole does, in the middle of the worst crisis we have ever seen at Rikers Island, they put him in on a technical parole violation. Couldn't think of any other way to work with this man and his family. They decided to throw him in Rikers.
Without bail. So even if he money to make bail, no bail.
Remand. The sad state of affairs is that Governor Hochul, and I commend her strong leadership, what she did on Friday literally did save lives, but unfortunately, not Mr. Kareem. And we're trying to get to the bottom of why he did not make a list, but even if he did, he was so sick at that point.
And so listeners know what she did on Friday. Are you talking about signing the Less is More bill and then releasing 191 inmates that were in, like Kareem, on sort of technical parole violations, but not new violent charges? And Tina, for people that don't know this, and I was talking to you last week about this, I was on a video call with my own client when all of a sudden there was this huge violent outbreak out of my eye shot, but not out of my earshot. And I could see my client reacting to it, and an inmate was being attacked. And it just was horrific watching from my desk and not being able to do anything about it. Yeah. But recently, representatives from the Legal Aid Society and other defenders took tours, and I think some politicians took tours of the island. They've reported back to you. Tell me what they witnessed so people understand visually, you know, intellectually, what the conditions are actually like. What did they see?
Report people coming off. So it was public defenders who, you know, we're not we're not a group of people who shake easily as public defenders, right? We know some of the conditions that have existed long at Rikers, right? They came off of those tours. The elected officials came off those tours physically shaken, crying, and furious at what they had seen. For instance, there was a person who was held in a shower, because that was the only place to keep, to hold him, because everything else was packed. He was in a shower cell, and there was no toilet. And so he was given a plastic bag to defecate in, to use as his own toilet. There were intake cells. So when bail is set or you're remanded on parole, you go to intake, where you're only supposed to be in intake for a very short period of time to do exactly that, right? They take your personal information, they figure out your medical needs, and the they is the Department of Correction, New York City's Department of Correction. You're then supposed to be transferred to a housing facility where you will have a bed, and a toilet, access to commissary, more food, access to recreation, right? But in intake, it's very short. Well, the intake cells were packed 4 to 5 times more than they should be. Usually it's one or two people in those intake cells because, again, it's very quick. Well, now you had 10 to 11 people in those cells, no toilet, no bed, no recreation, right? No medical care. Languishing there. People were running to the bars, to the electeds and the public defenders, begging people to help. One man was seen banging his head against the wall in need of mental health treatment. One elected reported that she and another elected
watched an attempted suicide by somebody who was clearly in need of mental health treatment, tie a sheet around his neck, and luckily for that man, unsuccessfully try to hang himself. But the corrections officer swarmed in and dragged him out of the cell. Reports of missed meals. Electives went to the housing area, what we call RNDC, where young people are held. These are people who are above the age of the age, which in New York is 17. So these are still young people, 18, 19 years old. They're supposed, but ironically, it was the first day of New York school for New York City. These kids were not getting any school. They were barely making meals. No programming, no recreation. So when you think about the work, think about all those stories we hear about jails in third world countries, right?
Right.
Here we are in New York City
with garbage, feces.
That's right.
Two really obvious questions that may not provide or allow for easy answers, but what's the cause of this? What happened recently that turned Rikers, which has never been anything much more than the old movie Escape from New York, if people recall that, what's happened to cause this crisis now? And more importantly, what can we do or what can be done to correct the situation expeditiously?
Yeah. So there's two factors here. The first is there is a staffing crisis for the corrections officers. So the Department of Corrections, again, it's a city agency under the administration of Mayor de Blasio, has a staffing crisis.
And there's about 6,000 inmates at Rikers, am I right?
That's right.
Okay.
So let's use the data, right? Right now there's roughly 6,000, slightly over 6,000 people at Rikers. Now, there was still an overwhelming number of corrections officers per people at Rikers. So if everyone was showing to work, they would have more officers than they needed. However, they're not. They're not showing up, right? There's enormous population, simply AWOL. Today, New York City filed a lawsuit against the Correction Officers Union. COBA, indicating that that New York City's position is that COBA is engaged in a job action and an illegal one under what we call the Taylor Act.
Stop for 1 second. I want to make sure for people who have been listening the whole hour, want to make sure this is a different union than the union that the Tyrone Covington is the president of. He's the president of the union for a federal facility in Manhattan, not for the corrections officers on Rikers. I just want to make that clarification.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that, because they are completely separate. So there's a staffing crisis. People are AWOL, not showing up to work. You have those who are showing up to work. Roughly the commissioner of corrections testified last week that about 403 of his staff are showing up day in, day out, some of them working triples, quadruples. At the same time, New York State, right before COVID hit, rolled back bail reform that allowed for more the judges and the DAs to ask and set more bail on more eligible crimes, including some misdemeanors and including more nonviolent felonies. So right now there's about 1,000 people who are in now on nonviolent crimes with bail set that they can't afford. Those two things happening is causing this crisis.
And so can we do to fix it?
Yeah. So the first thing is educate everybody, because we can't let this go without attention. Right.
But de Blasio's educated about this. Prosecutors are educated about this. Judges are educated about this. What should they be doing?
Turning a blind eye. And are turning, in my opinion, Mayor de Blasio, the DAs and the judges are at this point turning a blind eye. Mayor de Blasio has the power right now to release, under his power only, all about over 200 people who are at Rikers Island serving what we call a city sentence, right? A sentence of 12 months or less.
So that's for de minimis crimes, non-felonies.
That's right. These are non-felony charges, right? Or a felony charge that's so low, right, that the person is not at all, this is not a violent crime. It is likely might be a non-violent felony, grand larceny or something, where the person was able to get a city sentence.
So, like, to put it, right, and to put it in perspective, this is someone who, say, pled guilty to petty larceny for stealing sneakers, and as a result will be doing 3 months in the midst of garbage, feces, rotten food, urine, vomit, overcrowded conditions, mold, cockroaches, and violence, rampant violence and understaffing.
That's right. That's right.
Is that a fair sentence?
Right now, that's a fair sentence, right? That's a fair sentence. As well as somebody who's supposed to serve 8 months, but let's wrap our heads around it, right? These people would be coming home and will be coming home if by the grace of God, they survive. They will be coming home to our communities, to their families, to our neighborhoods, like, very soon. This mayor has the power to actually release them right now.
What has he said? Has he reacted?
Every time this question has been put to him by journalists, most recent Brian Lehr last week, the mayor says that's not our priority. My answer to the mayor is he should go to Rikers, which he has not done through this entire crisis and likely not at all in his second term. He should go take a look at what's going on and then have the nerve to tell people who are waiting to go home from their city sentence that they are not the priority. He won't.
I'm surprised that de Blasio has not yet gone. I mean, I'm not surprised, but
forgive me.
But he should. I mean, even for PR, do the trip.
Good riddance. You know?
Yeah.
Good riddance with him. He'll be gone in a few months.
He has the power to do that. He's refusing to do that. And instead, he keeps pointing the finger. So he pointed the fingers to the governor and said, well, the state can release people on technical parole violations.
And she did.
And she did. She doubled down and said, go ahead. And in fact, the governor stepped in to try to help the mayor by actually saying what the state will do is transfer those city sentenced people to state facilities to protect them more. Now, that's not the answer, and we all know that's not the answer, to take somebody from the city sentence and send a city.
Sometimes the intake takes longer than the sentence.
Right. The reality, and then you're sending people upstate, they're away from their families. Right. Why? Why? So that's the first. Right. That's the first thing that can happen. And he is cowardly turning his back on this.
This is just look, the three of us can sit here and complain. One of your brother, sister, co-agencies, the New York County Defender Service, issued a statement this afternoon calling for a 5-point plan to help this, or 4-point plan, excuse me. And the last point, they called for federal action to intervene to restore safety and basic operations at Rikers Island, to have the feds come in and take over the prison. I know that there's some precedence for this. When MCC had their problem it was about a year and a half ago now, COVID messes with the time somewhat, they found a gun in the facility, and the feds brought in dozens of officers from other states to come in and oversee the operations for a time. Where do you stand on having federal corrections officers, even from out of state, come in and take over Rikers Island?
That's not the answer. First of all, we have a federal monitor. I know Stan Hermont. He is a fighter.
Sam is the head of the New York County Defender's Office.
Yeah, he's the person who issued the statement, and I respect him very much, and the other points on his plan were all things all the defenders have been pushing and we will continue to push, but I disagree with him as to the getting federal officers to come into the to the system. That is not the answer.
But don't we, if staffing is an issue, don't we need somebody to come in? We need somebody to come in there and...
Remember, there's a federal lawsuit and there's a Nunez, where DOJ, right? DOJ is involved. So we're not saying there's no role here for federal action, right? And our Nunez team, including the DOJ, are working together, right, with the monitor, who issued three reports at this point to raise the awareness of the judge who oversees that. So I'm not at all saying federal action is not needed, and certainly DOJ looking at continuing to intervene is critical, no doubt. What I'm talking about is getting federal corrections officers to come in now in this situation. The answer here, first and foremost, because first of all, that lets de Blasio off the hook to decarcerate, the DAs off the hook to stop asking for bail, and the judges to stop setting it and to listen to bail review arguments, because the first thing we have to do is decarcerate. At the height of COVID, March, April, June of 2020, we all together, facing the pandemic, watching people die and get sick, all together, including the mayor using sick day, decarcerated down to 3,800 people, right? That we should be going there first. And then we got to look at staffing, right? I'm not saying that staffing is not a problem.
No, but right now it's a war zone and we only have 30 seconds left. And if you're in a war zone, what do? Take the most vulnerable out now and then restructure it.
And reinforce the troops.
Exactly.
That's right. Right now the answer is get people off of that don't belong. Mr. Cruz, let me talk to you about it. I got 30 seconds. Let me talk to you about
15. 10 seconds.
Why the PA and the judges play a critical role. 77-year-old man in a wheelchair is arrested for an altercation in a nursing home.
Tina, thanks so much for coming on. We'll see you all next week on Crime and Justice Radio.
Thank you, Tina.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.